So we're continuing on in our study, back into the text and trying to move forward in our study of 1 Corinthians. And we're going to be focusing today on verses 26 through 31, really to the end of chapter 1. But I think that it's going to be important to just recapture the entire context of this particular focal passage by starting the reading in verse 18. And of course, we've been quoting and reciting the passage in verse 18 and following for some time now, but it does kind of frame up or give us the right context for what we're going to focus in on today. So I invite you to turn with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and we'll pick up the reading in verse 18, and we'll read all the way through the end of the chapter and then start focusing in on our passage for the day. So Paul says, "For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." And now we get to our focal text for the day. "For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth, but God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And because of him, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness and sanctification and redemption. So that as it is written, let the one who boasts, boasts in the Lord." Now, of course, we are in this section that is dealing with wisdom and folly. And the Apostle Paul is drawing a stark contrast between what the world deems as folly, but is indeed the very wisdom of God, versus what the world deems as wise, which is actually foolishness that God will destroy. Okay, that's sort of the dichotomy, the comparison that he is drawing for us in this text. But you also have to remember, and I think it's important for us to remember, that what he's also primarily dealing with and what he really deals with for the better part of the first four chapters of this letter is this issue of divisiveness in the church. And you recall, it's been a while since we looked at it, but you recall from, for example, from verse 10, he starts by saying, "I appeal to you, brothers, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all agree and that there be no divisions among you, but that you being united in the same mind and the same judgment, that you be united, excuse me, in the same mind and the same judgment. For it has been reported to me by Chloe's people that there's quarreling among you, my brothers. And what I mean is this, that each one of you says, I follow Paul, I follow Apollos, or I follow Christ, or I follow Cephas, or I follow Christ." So he's basically continuing to deal with this issue of divisions in the church. And you'll see this as we continue on in our study, where he picks this back up. He begins to reference this divisive, these factious groups that have formed around these teachers. And he'll reference Apollos again. You'll see it kind of pick up again as we move through the text. But this is our context. So this is he's basically highlighting the folly of worldly wisdom that in a very major way manifests itself in the life of the church in the form of divisions and factions. Okay? Now, he's moving forward in his sort of his argument or his discussion about this outworking of human wisdom, which is really foolishness before God, in the area of divisions. And he's calling them to do something. He tells them to consider your calling. So he's basically going to take what he's been talking about in terms of the comparison of human wisdom versus the wisdom of God, or human wisdom and the folly of the cross, the word of the cross as he refers to it. He's now going to say, look, let me make this even more personal Let me drive this home even in a more particular or specific way. And he tells them in verse 26, for example, consider your own calling. Now, we're going to look at this from two different layers ultimately. But to start with, he is pointing out, he is basically conducting a basic demographic analysis of the church at Corinth. So there's this practical identification that he starts with in the call for them to consider their calling. And so as we think about this, we need to consider our calling as well as a church and as how we have been sort of collected together and what the sort of general demographic is of our church. And once again, notice that the emphasis here is not, and again, based upon what we've studied the last 4 weeks, it's important for us to highlight, the emphasis here is not on demographics that are typically identified in even churches today as being most important, and that is, you know, what's the age demographic, or what's the, you know, what are the particular needs of this particular age group, and how do we make sure we target our ministry specifically? I mean, it becomes very much an orientation toward sort of secular marketing strategy. How do we get the most people to buy our stuff based upon our clever marketing of our gospel trinkets kind of thing, you know? He doesn't create that kind of demographic breakdown. He creates a very different breakdown of demographics here, but it is nonetheless a sort of demographic analysis that he's putting before us. And he's asking the Corinthians, and by extension, asking us to think about, to contemplate, to really reflect upon deeply and to understand. And he says, consider your calling. So we're going to look at this issue of calling as part of the equation. But there is something to look at on a very practical level, and that's where we want to start. The practical observation of the demographic breakdown that he gives us. It's very practical. We'll start there. He says there's not many wise according to worldly standards. There are not many powerful according to worldly standards. You don't see the according to worldly standards prepositional phrase attached to all these demographic categories that he lays out, but it is implied in the text that it's part of all these three different categories. So when he's talking about not many wise according to the flesh, he's also talking about not many powerful according to the flesh. And he's talking about not many noble according to the flesh. So it's important that we understand he's specifically referencing what people are or are not in the flesh, or according to worldly standards, according to worldly measures. And he says, look at yourselves. Look around. Take stock of your own calling. You are not comprised of a plethora of worldly wise or worldly powerful or worldly noble. In fact, Celsus, this is interesting to think about too, Celsus was a second century philosopher and a staunch critic of Christianity. So not too many years after the time of the writing of this letter by the Apostle Paul to the Corinthians, you have this secular Greek philosopher named Celsus, and here's what he says. He says, their injunctions, speaking of Christians or churches, he says, their injunctions are like this, quote, let no one educated, no one wise, no one sensible draw near, for these abilities are thought by us to be evils. But as for anyone ignorant, anyone stupid, anyone uneducated, anyone who is a child, let him come boldly. So he's basically mocking Christians by saying, this is their call to the masses. Listen, we don't want the smart people. We don't want the wealthy people. We don't want the influential people. But if you're stupid, if you're ignorant, if you're a child, come on, you're welcome. So he's basically ascribing that as the actual intention of the church, which the irony of what we're studying right now is that that's not the impression that the Corinthians had even of themselves. In fact, they were like many of us can be. They were like many churches can be, like many believers can be, and certainly like secular unbelieving people can be. We place a tremendous amount of emphasis and value upon secular worldly measures of effectiveness or success, and we then draw conclusions about the intrinsic value of people based upon those conditions. And by the way, we are born with this. This is of the flesh. This is what he's saying. Wise according to the flesh. This is intrinsic in fallen, fleshly, worldly corruption. You and I did not have to be instructed to be this way. We emerged from the womb and began to manifest this at very early ages. And it comes into its almost pristine, exquisite prominence in middle school. I don't know if you've noticed that. But the fact of the matter is that having all of the raw materials in us that would drive us to align ourselves socially and to view and judge others socially by virtue of external worldly measures of smart, athletic, influential, articulate, attractive, on and on and on it goes. That's how society has functioned and always functions. And the Apostle Paul is saying that is of the flesh. It's just of the flesh. Make no mistake. Let's not be confused about that. And so Celsius wants to kind of mock Christians because that's kind of how the assembly took shape. And we'll see that it wasn't by their intention. In fact, the Corinthians wished they were something other than what they actually were that the Apostle Paul points out to them. They fancied themselves something other than what they actually were in this demographic analysis. That's the irony of all of this. So, but the fact of the matter is, he says, not many wise, not many powerful, not many noble. But before we kind of break that down a little bit more, I think it's important for us to point out, as we think about this on a very pragmatic level, and we're thinking about the demographics of a local church, of demographics of our local church in particular, as we're studying this, the demography of Corinth. He does say, not many. He does not say, not any. Okay? It's very important that we realize this, especially in light of what we just got finished studying. He does not say there were not any wise, and there were not any powerful, and there were not any noble. He says there were not many wise, powerful, and noble according to worldly standards, meaning that there are some. And really, the caution for us in this is an initial observation, especially in light of what we just studied and looking at critical race theory and how it has its sort of origins in sort of a Marxist idea of oppressor and oppressed classes and dividing everybody up into these kinds of classes and pitting classes against one another. He's not trying to do that at all. And so it's important for us to realize that there are some who are going to be called from these different classes. In other words, those of you who might even account yourself as, yeah, I'm definitely not one of the wise by worldly standards. Believe me, I know that. I took the SAT. It was horrible. You know, I'm not many powerful. Yeah, I get where I stand or whatever. You know, I'm not many noble. I mean, we can kind of self-identify. Yeah, I'm definitely in one of those three categories or maybe some combination of all three. I don't identify myself as wise or particularly influential or powerful or anything. I get it. But what is the subtle temptation for the fallen flesh is to somehow think that that makes you especially virtuous. And we can look at something like this and you can almost see how someone with a Christianized version of some kind of, you know, critical race theory analysis or even kind of a Marxist ideology would say, this is the justification for what we're talking about. Like, the church is made up of too many people who think that they're wise and think that they're powerful, and it's all about people with privilege and that kind of thing. And so really what we can say is the church is not supposed to be made up of all those kind of people, and we can say we're more virtuous because we're part of the not many wise. You see what I'm saying? In other words, the Apostle Paul is wanting to cut across all of that. Whether you're part of the wise or the not wise by worldly standards, don't get caught up into any of that kind of division, worldly division, when it comes to your calling. When it comes to your calling. It's important that we realize that. I mean, it'd be just absurd for anyone to adopt anything remotely resembling that when the very point of what he's talking about is not to introduce new means by which we divide ourselves in some kind of class arrangement or whatever. When the whole point is he's trying to drive them toward, rebuke them for their divisiveness and drive them toward unity. So we got to be careful with how we kind of interpret or see these kinds of things and the lenses we kind of interpret these things through. He's highlighting a real demographic here, so it's not like it's contrived, but he's also trying to obliterate all notions of worldly thinking that would contribute in any way whatsoever to factiousness in the church. But the fact of the matter is that there are some who are a part of what might be considered the wise, the worldly wise. And we'll talk about that a little bit, what that might mean. Or the powerful, or the noble, if you will, in the church. There's no rationale or reason for anyone in any church to have cause for looking upon anyone with any attitude of derision based upon these kinds of status categories, okay, regardless of what it is. And I think that there's a tendency for us to do that no matter what the category is. Some people, even in the confessing Christian community of believers in various churches, find themselves drawn to and wanting to rub shoulders with and spend time with people who they deem to be worldly wise or successful in some way, or maybe have money. They want to kind of cozy up to them because of that thing. And they look at those sort of achievements or those accomplishments as something, and this is a very subtle temptation, but that becomes the aspiration. So you could have someone in the context of a local church who has definitely achieved some type of status that from a worldly perspective, the world at large would look at them and go, they've made it. That's the picture of success. Whether it's financial wealth of some kind or some other measure of worldly success, even the world would look at them and say, they're successful. But they might also be very faithful, very godly people. Genuinely faithful followers of Jesus Christ. And the call to every believer in a fellowship with people like that is not to want to be around them so that you can sort of aspire to their worldly greatness, but so that faithfulness that the Lord is working out in them in spite of their worldly success. This is very important for us to understand. In spite of the fact that they have worldly success, that God, by His grace, is working in them the fruit of genuine repentance and genuine salvation in profound and rich ways. It's almost as though you want to say, how does someone who has achieved so much in the world, in the area of worldly measures of success, how do they remain faithful? Because all I know is that if I were in that position, I would be likely to get very easily distracted by my desire for stuff or my desire for whatever. You see that? See how that works? To be drawn toward one another for the faithfulness that God is working out in and through their lives, regardless of station, regardless of worldly measures of success. This cuts both ways. It's important that we see that. Selina Hastings was the Countess of Huntingdon. She lived from 1707 to 1791. She was born August 24th, 1707. She was the daughter of Lord Washington Shirley and Lady Mary Shirley. She was a child of privilege. She spent her childhood in Leicestershire. I believe that that's a town or an area in Ireland, and I do believe it is an actual word that has 17 syllables, the way I just pronounced it. Anyway. In a shire in Ireland, she lived there on her family's estates, grew up there. In 1728, she married Theophilus Hastings, the 9th Earl of Huntingdon, and this marriage gave her the title Countess of Huntingdon. She was of noble birth. She was an aristocrat. She was very well stationed. She was someone with tremendous financial means and resources at her disposal. And yet, in his biography of George Whitefield, Arnold Dalimore notes this, quote, "The remarkable Christian witness of that Lady Huntingdon maintained among Britain's nobility. The biographer goes on to say, in fact, as one of her own biographers tells us, quote, Lord and Lady Huntington constantly attended wherever Whitfield preached. As a result, she grew to be a devout Christian, passionate about inviting others of British nobility to hear this remarkable preacher and the gospel he preached. Or as another Whitfield biographer, Luke Tyerman, wrote, wherever she went, she took her religion with her, for her religion was a part of herself. And Countess Huntington herself, commenting on this particular passage in 1 Corinthians, said this, blessed be God, it does not say any mighty, any noble. It says many mighty, many noble. And then she says this, I owe my salvation to the letter M. It's pretty clever. So the point of that is that, listen, this is someone who the Lord, I mean, the story of this countess is really a phenomenal story. I mean, she had intersections in ministry with the Wesley brothers and with Whitfield and starting hospitals. I mean, she was a profound and impactful follower of Christ in her day. And yet she was a part of the nobility, like full-on nobility. So the point here is just to give you a historical reference point of this fact, that it's not any, but it's many. And we know, even in Corinth, there were some people of genuine societal influence, but also genuine faith. A few examples, Crispus, he was a synagogue ruler in Corinth, and he believed the gospel. We see this in Acts chapter 18, and he also references him in 1 Corinthians 1:14. We have Gaius. He was one of the few that Paul baptized. We see that mentioned in verse 14 of 1 Corinthians. But he's also mentioned in Romans chapter 16 as the host of Paul and the whole church, which would indicate means. It would indicate wealth for them to host Paul and the whole church in his home. We have Erastus, who was a city treasurer in Corinth, who Paul also mentions in Romans 16, 23. So he was a person of influence and position politically in the community. And then you have Stephanus, who was likely a well-to-do member of the community in Corinth, whom Paul baptized and whom also delivered this letter. And Paul, you'll see him reference this at the end of the letter, he entrusts this letter to Stephanus and calls upon the Corinthians to respond well to him in his delivery of the letter. So we know that there were faithful people of worldly influence in the church. But the key about them was not their worldly influence, but their faithfulness in spite of it, in the face of it, in the midst of it. Now, he does make a compelling point here about the many who were called by God and believed the gospel. We see this in Acts chapter 8, verses 8 to 9. Many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized. And then Paul has a vision where Jesus actually tells him in this vision, I have many in this city who are my people. So of the many, many people came to faith in Christ in Corinth. Of the many, there are the not many. And he says, the not many were wise according to worldly standards. These are those, you could say, who were a part of maybe the elite Greek intelligentsia, the philosophical class, the teacher class, the lecturing class, the ideas class of people, the bright lights of intellect in that community. You have the not many powerful, according to worldly standards, which, pretty straightforward, those with meaningful influence and prominence in the community, probably by way of either wealth or political influence. And often those two things went hand in hand in this day and time as they do in our day and time, right? I mean, it's kind of, nothing's really changed too much. It's not always a direct corollary, but it's certainly often a corollary. So, except in our country, people may not be wealthy when they go to places of power, but somehow they become wealthy in the, you know, their tenure. It's kind of an interesting dynamic. But that's probably a discussion for another day, I'm guessing. But that's what you can kind of think of when you think of the powerful, those that are influential, like legitimately influential people. They have some level of authority and influence by virtue of wealth, political position, and that kind of thing. And then you have this reference to the not many noble, according to worldly standards. And this would refer just simply to those who are well-born, is another way to define that term. Those who are maybe born into some kind of aristocratic family, some type of ruling family of some sort, is the idea here. And in the life of the church in Corinth, there were not many of those people in the body. Out of the many, there weren't many that were like this. There were only a few. This was the actual demographic makeup of the church at Corinth. But here's the thing. It is and always has been and always will be the predominant demographic makeup of the church at large. Always has, always will be. In fact, I would argue by virtue of the authority of God's word and just the nature in which the Apostle Paul places this under the inspiration of the Spirit in this context in Corinth and what he's actually talking about, I would argue that we can be sure, we can be confident that if at any point in time a church becomes predominantly populated by those who are of the worldly wise by worldly measures and of the worldly powerful by worldly measures and of the worldly noble, whatever that might look like in our country, if the demographics of any local church becomes predominantly populated by that kind of ilk, then you can mark it down. Apostasy is already there or it's not far behind. It's not lagging. Now, why would I say that? That almost sounds like counterintuitive to what I've kind of pounced on earlier in the deal about not looking upon. I'm not talking about people in a way that says, listen, here's what we got to do. The next time someone shows up, by the way, this is part of your hospitality and greeter team training. If someone shows up and you get any sense that they've got money, you might want to, I mean, we're probably getting a little bit full of those kind of people. We got to turn them away, right? Of course, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just making an observation based upon the text, but also what we've seen all throughout history. Now, why is that? Because what happens to people who have worldly acclaim? It's intoxicating. It becomes a consuming thing and a controlling thing, and it's one of the fuels of pride. And God is opposed to the proud and gives grace to the humble. And so what you see over and over again, we saw this even in our country with some of the mainline denominations that became populated with tremendous wealth. And so basically these churches kind of descended into some kind of sanctified sort of materialistic social club. That's what the church was. Because that's the tendency of the human flesh. So the challenge here for us is, I think, pretty straightforward. We simply need to be focused on aspirations that are true and that are according to true wisdom, that are about gospel realities working out in real time in the lives of God's people in such a way that we can observe legitimate fruit being born. We are not to be led astray or become intoxicated or infatuated by people simply because they have some kind of worldly success or worldly achievement that we think would be nice to associate with. There's caution in this for any church. This was the actual demographic of the church in Corinth, and it's really the demographic of the church throughout the ages. In fact, if you go back to the Constantinian era of the church, I mean, what ended up happening in that pivotal point in history? You have these initial centuries of church history where primarily the church was suffering under some form and some measure of persecution to varying degrees of intensity, through varying levels of edict from emperors and that kind of thing. But nevertheless, the general thread through the first several centuries of the church's history is a story of some degree of persecution. And so there really wasn't any way from a societal standpoint for people in the church who are genuinely devoted followers of Jesus Christ and genuinely called as followers of Christ, there was really no means or mechanism or economic pathway for those people in general or in the main to rise to levels of prominence because they were outcasts or they were troublemakers or they were lawbreakers or they were even considered idolaters because instead of bowing down to Caesar, they bowed down to this strange deity. I mean, whatever the case may be, Christians were accused of being cannibals because, you know, when they took communion, they said, this is my body, which is broken for you, take and eat. I mean, that kind of thing. So there's all kinds of things that were attributed to believers in the first few centuries that would not put them on the pathway toward worldly success or achievement or notoriety. But then, in the Constantinian era, Constantine rises to the emperorship. He basically seizes it through conquest and through power. And I'm not going to go into all the history, but he basically becomes some version of a Christian, okay? It's a little bit debatable about the sincerity and genuineness of his conversion, but nevertheless, he adopts Christianity as the religion of the empire. And so all the shackles and all the constraints and all the laws and everything that constrained the church were opened up, and in fact, he instituted laws and policies that gave favor to the church. And the church during that era grew and expanded both in terms of number of people confessing Christian belief, and I say that with emphasis, confessing it, not necessarily being part of the called, but confessing it as an act of good citizenship oftentimes. But also it grew in tremendous wealth and power and influence and was basically the foundational seeds of what is now the Roman Catholic Church. So this is what happens throughout time immemorial with God's people. In fact, what we know as we study history is that the church, the true church, has always thrived and grown in the seasons of the most intense constraint and persecution. Because that's the primary mechanism in this life and in this world that the Lord uses to conform us to the image of Christ. It's trial and suffering and persecution. So it just, all of it makes sense, right? All of it stands to reason. So we need to be mindful of this principle. And notice, as he's calling us to consider this kind of demographic reality. That's sort of the practical observation. But there's also a preview here. He's giving a preview of what's to come. And it's really a preview of a rebuke that's coming. And I'll just read to you from chapter 4, verses 6 through 8. He's basically beginning to sum up this entire section in chapter 4, verses 6 through 8, when he says, I have applied all these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, brothers, that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written. Here it is, that none of you may be puffed up in favor of one against another. For who sees anything different in you? Get that? There are some who are wise according to worldly standards. There are some who are powerful according to worldly standards. And there are some who are noble according to worldly standards. And yet here at the conclusion of this entire section, the Apostle Paul is saying, who sees anything different in you? In other words, those distinctions don't matter. He goes on, what do you have that you did not receive? So even those of you who might have achieved something in this world from a worldly standard of measure, take heed. These are gifts from the hand of the God who owns everything and graciously provides everything. Down to the very level of the air that you breathe, all the way to the gifts and talents and abilities that you've been able to leverage to achieve whatever success you've achieved. What do you have that you did not receive? And then he says, if then you received it, why do you boast as if you did not receive it? This was the Corinthians. Already you have all you want. Already you have become rich. Without us, you have become kings, he says, with a not-so-subtle hint of sarcasm. He's setting them up for a rebuke. I mean, imagine, here we are, this collection of people in this class, and we think we're something special. We think that we are, you know, we've achieved something great. We're some super spiritual, but we're also liked in the community, and everybody thinks that we're just this awesome group of people. And then someone comes along and says, you're none of that. Never were. Consider your calling. Their mindset is, we've already become kings. We're so wonderful and great. We have all these gifts on display. We on and on and on it goes. And he just cuts right through that. So on two levels here, he's saying, this is the actual demographic of the church, but he's also previewing what is going to be a sharp rebuke. Whatever it is you thought about yourself, just you don't even have to think deeply. Just look around. Just observe reality for a moment. And you'll see. Not many wise. Not many powerful. Not many noble. In fact, he's alluding in this concluding section to the fact that you didn't receive not just the gifts that you have that might make you worldly wise in some way or recognized in some way from a worldly standard, but you aren't even responsible for the fact that you're getting this letter and that you're a part of the church. You were called. You received a calling. You didn't arrive at some place of intellectual clarity where you said, oh, okay, I now understand the philosophical nuances of Christianity versus Stoicism, or Christianity versus Epicureanism, or Christianity versus whatever. It's not that. You were called out of darkness and death, and you were brought into the church and into Christ, and you were given new life in Him. You received that. So you have this consideration here that he's calling them to, this first consideration, and it is this consideration of the actual demographics of the church. And it's also a prelude to this rebuke that he'll get into as we move forward, and we'll see it culminate in, as we already have, in chapter 4. But let's also consider one more thing. We'll just get started with this, and then we'll pick up here next week. We can also, with the Apostle Paul, we can consider the devastating outcome of this call. So you have the demographics that he mentions initially, the demographic analysis of the called, and now you have the devastating consequences or the devastating outcome of the call. And what are we talking about here? Look at verse 27 and verse 28. So after he kind of highlights who they actually are, and really, more specifically, who they're mostly not. Verse 27, he says, but God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even the things that are not, to bring to nothing the things that are. This is sort of a compliment, almost a mirror of what he's already said when he says, when he quotes from the Old Testament in Isaiah, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. He's basically now pulling that same idea into this very personal illustration of what he's talking about by saying it wasn't just that this is the demographic makeup of the church, but this is actually a part of God's intention and how he has configured the church. And he's done it for a very specific reason, and it's to accomplish what he says he has accomplished and he will always accomplish, and that's to thwart the wisdom of the world, the wisdom of the wise, to destroy it, to make it not. And he even uses this kind of language in this section, and it goes sort of this descending description of moving from nothing to greater nothingness, basically, is what he's doing here. So in case there's any misunderstanding about what he's talking about in terms of the outcome of this call, particularly for those who count themselves among the worldly wise and are not counted among those who are being saved, as he talks about earlier in this passage, but he's basically drawing a sort of a funnel down to greater degrees of degraded, despised nothingness. is what the objective is that God will accomplish, and how He is assembled, He is chosen, He is called the church, the true church of God. He chose what is foolish, and He chose what is weak, and He chose what is low and despised in the world, even the things that are not. And that's as low as you can go. He's basically alluding to, this would have been in sort of in first century Greek parlance, this would have been the one of the greatest insults you could give someone, because basically you're just denying that they have any worth that would constitute them having a value as a being. It's basically saying you are less than nothing. And this is the intent and purpose, really the devastating outcome for worldly wisdom and those who would ascribe to that and count themselves among that as though that's the end for them to achieve, that God, by intention, by design, He has chosen and assembled the elect, the church, as an intentional means by which He brings about the shame of the worldly wise. He brings about the shame of those who are strong. Now, this kind of thing, it probably is not particularly useful or maybe even very wise for us to speculate too much about how some of this might actually play out in application. But I do think it's kind of an interesting thought exercise to consider when you think about, in our modern American society in the main, when you think about those types of people, those classes of people, or those positions of some kind of power or authority that are, you know, attributed with, you know, prestige or something like that. You can think of people in sort of our modern day intelligentsia, people who are really high-minded in the collegiate and university areas or whatever it might be. You just think about these different categories and just sort of, you know, draw some common sense conclusions about what that profile might look like in our particular society. And to think about what destroying that type of wisdom or that type of power or that type of nobility, what that might look like. And the fact of the matter is that we see this kind of thing happening over and over and over again on individual and on collective bases. How many times have you and I seen someone who seems to be at the top of their game? And pick your arena, pick your sport, pick your area of entertainment, pick your realm of political influence, pick whatever it is, and they seem to be at the top of their game. And they're on every news show, or they're on every cover of every magazine, or whatever. And they're sort of the it guy or the it girl, only to find out at some point down the road that events are transpiring that lead to their massive downfall. Happens all the time. But for that time, there is an intoxicating effect by the fans around them, the admirers around them, to almost ascribe to them some kind of invincibility as a result of whatever it is they're manifesting that's so worldly attractive. And oftentimes, and this is the way our society is, oftentimes, once the news of the downfall is sort of generally reported, everybody's just out of sight, out of mind, and nobody even thinks about it anymore. Every once in a while, you might see one of these, you know, exposés of whatever happened to so-and-so, right? And you see them, you know, I don't know, all drugged out, walking, I don't know, whatever, photos have taken of them. And you know, they don't look at all like what they used to look like when they're on the cover of magazines, right? So that could be one manifestation, one sort of natural consequence, sort of in the providential workings of God, that people who fancy themselves among the worldly wise or prestigious or powerful, that they have to face the consequences of all their actions and stand before the judge of all creation, and they have to reap whatever it is they sow, no matter who they are, no matter how many Facebook hits they have or whatever, hashtag this or that, whatever the right language is, right? Doesn't matter. So we need to be mindful of this reality, that there is the tendency of us, and I think that, you know, I think that I know that most of us, if not all of us, we know the distinction in our minds, right? We know that there's really no reason for us to look at our favorite, you know, celebrity or favorite actor, actress, or athlete, or whatever. We don't in our minds look at them with some type of fawning admiration that would, you know, be bent toward idolatry or something like that. I think we all get that. But the question is, have we ever thought in our minds, have we ever adopted, even from the standpoint of just a little bit of a working philosophy or ideology, this kind of idea? Wouldn't it be awesome if such and such became a believer? You know, in fact, Jordan Peterson is probably one of the latest ones that I've, you know, had some conversations about that. And you know, I would say, well, yes, in the same way that, you know, Jack or Jill Schmo walking down the street, it would be awesome if they became a believer. It's an awesome thing when the sovereign God of the universe calls someone out of darkness and transfers into the kingdom of light. It's an awesome thing. So yeah, Jordan Peterson would be awesome. But so would XYZ. Do you see how that thinking can kind of even seep in a subtle way? And in so doing, we in a way diminish, as he talks about earlier in this chapter, the power of the cross. We diminish the wonder of the saving work of God in just that subtle way because we begin to think in worldly ways about the salvation of some intellectual or some celebrity or some great person. I remember when I was young, I was really guilty of this. When you start to hear, you know, this is really, you know, revealing. But, you know, it's that way of thinking where you hear some athlete talk about God after, you know, having a great game, and you're thinking, man, it would be so awesome if they became a Christian. Imagine all the people that get saved because of their, and it's like, come on. That's sort of an immature, childish way of looking at it. But we have our sophisticated, more adult, more mature ways of doing the very same thing, don't we? So the Apostle Paul is calling us, consider your calling. Look around. Take note of the fact that it is not God's normal pattern to populate local assemblies with a preponderance of the worldly wise and the worldly powerful and the worldly prestigious and the worldly noble. In fact, it's quite the opposite. In fact, when you hear and read testimonies of those who, like the countess that I just referenced, what you see is you see them having greater brokenness and greater gratitude over the saving work of God because He saved them in spite of their nobility, in spite of their perceived greatness or whatever it might be. So the genuine work of God accomplishes the very same thing in every true believer. It opens their eyes to the reality of their own corruption, their mortal, eternal corruption before a holy God, and their desperate need to cry out for mercy and for grace through the Savior, regardless of station in life and regardless of how the world might measure your wisdom or power or nobility or success. We'll probably pick this up a little bit and fill this out a little bit more next week, and then we'll go on to look at the determined purpose of the caller. What ultimately is God doing in this pattern of who He calls and who He doesn't typically call to be His bride, to be His church? Let's close in prayer.